Thank you. Our third presenter is Joshua Meeks. Joshua just received his PhD in history. I guess you defended, what, 2 weeks ago? Okay, wonderful. Yet another freshly minted PhD from Florida State. Go team. Today he'll be speaking on, I'm sorry, I left my program here. Apologies for that. Today he'll be speaking on Resources and Revolution, the Struggle for Corsican Timber. Joshua.
Thank you very much. It's exciting to be on this panel. I'm really looking forward to hearing the comments, and it's especially because this paper, it is very much a work in progress. It was initially part of a larger work looking at the role of the minor powers in the struggle for the Western Mediterranean between Britain and France. I ultimately ended up going in a more military political direction. And so this is kind of an attempt to bring back in some of the environmental aspects that I'd looked at early on in my research. So to start off, I'll start off with a quote. Corsica is a nuisance. There she is, like a wen on her nose. Choiseul once said that if Corsica could be pushed under the sea with a trident, it should be done. He was quite right. It's nothing but a nuisance. Those are the words of Napoleon Bonaparte about his birthplace. And he was not alone in viewing Corsica as a nuisance in the 18th century. Now, despite playing a key strategic role in the struggle for dominance in the Mediterranean, the island of Corsica was a continual drain on the resources of whichever state possessed it. In the first half of the 18th century, this was the Genoese. But after nearly continuous rebellion, the Genoese sold Corsica to the French in 1769. The French took the island primarily as a precaution against expanding British power in the Mediterranean, but they failed to integrate the island into the French state, leaving its natural resources unexploited as venality and misadministration continually plagued the island under the old regime. The revolutionaries, in turn, made plans to integrate the island into the new revolutionary state, but as we shall see, to exploit and to take advantage of Corsica's natural resources, especially timber, but they too were unable to solidify their hold on the island, losing control in 1793. Finally, after a brief interlude of British rule between 94 and 96, Corsica was definitively made a part of the French state, but it still took many decades before any sort of progress was made toward developing the resource potential of the island. It remained a drain on the state, a wen on the nose of France, a nuisance. So what were the causes for these struggles as different states sought to utilize the natural resources of Corsica? There are several answers on a geopolitical level, with the strategic placement of the island making it an enticing but often contested point. Socially, the island was fraught internally with clan rivalries and constantly mismanaged by its external rulers. In this paper, I'll seek to put these social and political issues in the context of the Corsican environment, linking together the failures of the state with the inability to develop and exploit the natural resources of the island. As long as Corsica remained unstable and unwelcoming to the French state remained reluctant or unable to invest in the development of the island's resources. Consequently, as long as the island's resources remained undeveloped, Corsica would continue to remain a drain on the resources of the state. This vicious cycle continued throughout the 18th century with few opportunities for deviation. Now, the cycle did begin with the Genoese. Their administration of the island was fraught with problems, primarily stemming from their ill treatment of the Corsicans. The governors of the island were notorious for their ruthless exploitation and their utter neglect for development and justice. The Genoese saw Corsica purely as a colony, and in the 16th and 17th centuries actively repressed the Corsican nobility. This created a clear hierarchy between the Genoese and the Corsicans. A side effect of this separation was a neglect for the infrastructure of the island. The Genoese nobility were far more interested in personal gain than in making Corsica into a productive participant in Genoese economics. The administration of Corsica was not a particularly prestigious post, so the Doge often gave it to poorer nobility. These nobility took any subsidies or funds for infrastructure development and pocketed it for themselves. The reason why I keep mentioning infrastructure development as important is that to utilize the natural resources of the island, the most important aspects were roads, which would provide aspect to the timber, which was found in the mountainous interior of the island, but also industry, providing a use for the timber on the island itself. Perhaps equally important, though, in the separation between Corsicans and Genoese was the fact that the Genoese stayed predominantly on the coastal cities, and effectively abandoning the mountainous and wooded interior of the island to the Corsicans. Left to their own devices, the mountain villagers developed an agrarian economy that was not based on the needs of any state, but on the exploitation of the resources offered by the different climate and soil conditions at the varying altitudes. Above 600 meters began what Corsicans regarded as mountain, where chestnut forests provided the staple flour. Small fields of barley and wheat provided the bare minimum, really, for subsistence. More popular was to rely on huge herds of goats and sheep, which gave milk, cheese, and some meat. However, these same herds would provide one of the chief obstacles to development, as they were traditionally allowed to roam completely free, severely diminishing the amount of land suitable for forestry. So by the 18th century, the island of Corsica had become a severe drain on the resources of Genoa. They kept their hold in an effort to maintain some vestige of their former glory, but they put too heavy of a burden on the island with too light of a military or state presence to actually take advantage of any of the island's natural resources. This resulted in a nearly successful rebellion from the Corsicans in the 1750s and 60s, and the Genoese found themselves completely unable to combat this threat. They asked the French for help, as they had in the past, but in exchange, this time, the French wanted the island entirely for themselves. The Genoese were in no position to argue, eventually agreeing to sell Corsica to the French for the sum of 40 million livres. This was a strategic move by the French, with the instability on the island and the weakness of the Genoese leaving Corsica open to intervention from other powers, especially the British, the Austrians, and the Russians, who all showed interest. In addition to the strategic importance, there were initially some grand plans to demonstrate the ability of the French state to practice enlightened despotism, but these attempts were slow and often failures. To again return to the words of Choiseul, it would have perhaps been preferable for Corsica to be pushed into the sea with a trident, but barring that occurrence, France needed to ensure that they alone among the great powers had influence on the island. So the acquisition of Corsica did have strategic and perhaps ideological value then, but at what cost? In addition to the upfront cost of the 40 million livres to subdue the rebellious forces on the island, the French were forced to send 50,000 troops. These troops only barely managed to defeat the Corsican forces in 1769, leaving the French as unwelcome masters of the island. Now, these subsequent enlightened uplift efforts were also very expensive. Environmentally, they included efforts to drain malarial lagoons, to build roads linking the major cities, especially in the north, and also several tree plantations were started, specifically of mulberry trees. Nearly across the board, however, these efforts were met with strong resistance from the Corsican population, and it quickly became apparent that for the island to become self-sufficient, much less profitable, a considerable amount of time and money would need to be devoted to increasing the French presence on the island, and only then exploiting the natural resources. Part of this issue was that the French simply did not know exactly what resources were available. Silk, as well as the mulberry bushes, were a small source of income, but not nearly enough to offset the payments to the Genoese, much less the upkeep of the military stationed on the island. One effort to remedy this relative ignorance came in the guise of a cartographic enterprise, the Plan Terrier. The instructions to this plan declared, "Corsica is a devastated country, that devastated, depopulated country that must be regenerated." Now, to regenerate a country is to give it the full existence of which it is capable in its population, its agriculture, and its commerce, not only in what they have been and what they are, but in what they can become, end quote. Now, the early reports, however, made it clear that the situation on Corsica was not very encouraging. The plan found that only 9% of the soil was good, 47% was classified as mediocre, and 24% classified simply as bad. Beyond that, the rest of the island's surface consisted of water and bare rock. The crop choice as well was considered irrational, with most of the fruit trees, except figs, were regarded as of poor quality. Given the lack of transportation systems within the island, wheat was grown everywhere, even where the land was not suitable. Since wheat was only planted every 5 years, the tough underbrush of the maquis grew back during the 4 years of fallow. The shallow plowing that followed the burning of the maquis only permitted the more luxuriant growth of the weeds. And finally, to add to these issues, the large herds of goats were constantly aiding in the destruction of the soil cover. The plan placed the blame for this poor state of affairs primarily on the Genoese, and likely rightly so. To address these issues and the inherent poverty of the island, the French would need to disrupt the established patterns of poor environmental decision-making and impose upon the islanders a strict regimen of forestation and further development. This, in turn, required a strong state that had a healthy relationship between Corsica and France, in this case. The old regime ultimately provided neither of these things. After 5 years of military rule, the treasury was given control of the island, and infrastructure development waned. Instead, the French began to treat Corsica in a nearly identical fashion, colonial fashion, as the Genoese. The appointments to the island became increasingly corrupt and venal. And to quote one Corsican in the period, the French acted as a swarm of locusts, descending upon the island to make personal profit and ignore the much needed at this point development of the island's resources. Thus, throughout the 20 years of rule of Corsica by the old regime, the island was, again, a continual drain on the resources of a French state that could ill afford such a burden, but could also not afford to remedy the issue with extended and proactive development. By 1789, the island cost the French government roughly 900,000 livres a year. Part of this was the disproportionate military cost of maintaining the unruly island. But a large part was because Corsica contributed virtually nothing to its own upkeep. Now, the coming of the French Revolution brought the possibility of change to Corsica. The Corsicans desperately sought fair treatment from the French, and to that end put a great deal of effort into integrating themselves into the revolution. And in November of 1789, the revolutionaries did make the decision to welcome Corsica into France as an integral part of the nation. In many ways, this was seen as necessary. The quasi-colonial governance of Corsica had clearly failed. Several reports had been issued that brought to light the disastrous nature of Corsican economics and taxation, and the continual drain on the finances of the French state needed to be remedied. Theoretically, a close relationship with the revolutionary state would finally allow Corsica to be governed fairly and to meet its potential in terms of resources. Corsica would gain liberty as part of the French nation, and the French nation would reap the economic benefits of the island's natural resources. To this end, in this optimistic vein, in 1790, one Foucard de Chateau put before the National Assembly a proposal for how to best utilize the island's resources, specifically the forests. He began by noting up front the burden that Corsica had been up to this point on France, wondering whether Corsica could ever truly be self-sufficient. Nonetheless, in his proposal, he took as his goal not simply the short-term exploitation of the island, but a vision for the long-term improvement and utilization of the island's resources. The proposal painted an enticing picture of the possibility afforded especially by Corsican timber. Altogether, Foucard estimated 420,000 acres of forest that could produce upwards of 27 million cords of wood. He also noted that there were an additional 1,120,000 acres of uncultivated and open land that currently contained only shrubs, but was fit for planting forests and agriculture. Now, the first component of his analysis assumed the least advantageous use of the timber, which would be making it into charcoal or essentially using it as kindling. Using this as a baseline, Foucard estimated the total value of Corsican wood at 356 million livres. This was perhaps optimistic, but he went through a great deal of detail in coming to this figure. And this was more than enough to turn the island profitable. Now, he was quick to point out, however, that this was the least profitable use of the forests, and that proper use could triple their value. His next proposal was to look to using timber on the island as using it to build ships, ideally on Corsica itself. He advocated the use of oak holm for merchant ships and pine for masts, both of which did exist on Corsica, but admittedly not in great quantities. Now, the big problem with this proposal lay in the fact that no shipbuilding industry actually existed on the island. Again, the Corsicans had prioritized their mountain dwellings, while the Genoese and French in the coastal cities had failed to develop any sort of proper facilities. Foucault did entertain the idea of shipping the timber elsewhere, but ultimately rejected this due to the initial cost of moving the timber from the mountains to the coast without suitable roads or adequate rivers. Again, this infrastructure development, a key obstacle. Overall, then, he discouraged relying entirely on the island for naval timber, but did open it up as a possibility for the future if the proper facilities were developed on Corsica. His third and final proposal, and the one in which he saw the greatest potential, was to use the timber to supply fuel for iron-producing forges. This, he argued, was the best and most profitable way of developing the forests of Corsica. He goes through an in-depth analysis of the potential avenues for development that I won't go over too much here, but he advocated the use of Catalonian forges, iron ore from the island of Elba, and the Corsican timber as fuel, and the production actually taking place on Corsica. In total, he estimated that the sustainable annual profit from iron to succeed 6 million livres. Overall, between the iron, the ship timber, and the fuel, he estimated that the exploitation of Corsica's forests could potentially result in an annual profit of 8 million livres. His proposal noted, however, and I quote, that these advantages accrue from the application of general industry to objects hitherto disregarded and totally neglected, end quote. Recognizing this initial difficulty, he then proposed how to actually go about this development. Focusing specifically on the region of Niulin, he detailed the problems and the possible solutions. I've already mentioned the issues, some of the issues regarding roads and rivers, but I want to pay special attention to the animosity that Foucault reserved for these herds of Corsican goats. He noted that the current economic system was based around reserving a few acres for barley and then allowing the rest of the land to be roamed free by the goats. Frustration evident, he asked, and this is a somewhat extensive quote, but I think it hits some good themes. In what country are goats permitted to graze in the fertile uplands and plains? Are they not, on the contrary, everywhere combined to the summits and places of difficult access? These animals, therefore, feed where no other culture can be attended to that would turn to a better account. Ought the state to be deprived of the use and value of the extensive forests and woods which this canton contains merely to gratify the wishes of the inhabitants of this Pieve? Now, aside from the monetary benefits, which he goes on to elucidate in great detail, he also argues that the land clearing and optimization of the land for woods would increase the population of the island. It would form more reservoirs, create more agricultural and industrial occupations, would improve air quality, and finally also encourage foreign investment on the island. In essence, in the view of Foucault, the cure for the ills of Corsica were found in the proper exploitation of the natural timber resources of the island. Ultimately, however, Foucault was never given the opportunity to put this plan into action. Between 1790 and 1793, Corsica steadily distanced itself politically from France, with the promises of the revolution ultimately coming up empty. By the middle of 1793, the island had effectively broken from France. Any dreams of developing the natural resources were once again stymied by the antagonism between Corsicans and their quasi-imperial overlords, in this case the French revolutionaries. This pattern continued while the British controlled the island from 1794 to 1796. The British didn't necessarily fall into the same trap of exploiting the island for personal gain, but nor were they at any point able to exert control over the inhabitants, especially not in terms of economic reform or environmental development. One interesting statistic here is that from 1789 to 1797, not a single taxes at all were collected on the island of Corsica. After the French retook the island in 1796, this overall theme again remained true. Throughout the 19th century, Corsica remained on the fringe of the French state, and there was a continual struggle for the use of the island's resources. So, to conclude this paper, the title is The Struggle for Corsican Timber. Now, perhaps a more accurate title would have been The Struggle of Corsican Timber. When I first started research and when I first proposed this project, I thought that, like, on the political side of things, Corsica's natural resources would be a flashpoint for conflict between France and Britain as they struggled against each other for control of the region. Instead, I found that neither side was at all able to take advantage of the resources of the island, as the antagonism between the Corsican population and their external rulers extended beyond the political and into the environmental. Thus, the struggle for Corsican timber was not for control over the resources of the island, but was in fact to use these resources at all. Thank you.